I always feel at that point when the book diverges from what your vision of it is always a good point to read. It's the point at which the book has acquired its own pulse, when it says, actually, I'm not going from A to B, like your diagram says, I'm going from A to C or D. I always think that's a really good moment when it takes off on its own momentum.
Welcome to In Writing. That was Maggie O'Farrell. I'm Hattie Crissell, and this is the last episode of the current series of In Writing. We're closing on a great guest, though. Maggie is the author of 8 novels, starting with her 2000 debut, After You've Gone, which won the Betty Trask Award, and her most recent is Hamnet, which last year won the Women's Prize for Fiction. It tells the tale of Shakespeare's son, who died when he was 11. Maggie also wrote I Am, I Am, I Am, 17 Brushes with Death. It's a totally unique memoir that charts her life in near-death experiences. I actually found it so gripping and so unsettling that I had to make a rule with myself that I was only going to listen to it in the bath, because when I read it in bed, I would just lie there full of adrenaline afterwards and not be able to sleep. She's also recently published her first children's book, Where Snow Angels Go, with illustrations by Daniela Jaglenka Terezini. Maggie spoke to me from her home in Edinburgh in early March. She works in an adapted Victorian greenhouse enclosed on one side by a stone wall and on the other by conifer trees. She told me that at one point she also had 2 separate desks set up, one for each book that she's thinking about writing. Her work is full of atmosphere, and speaking to her, I noticed that she has this writerly way even of talking about writing. She talks about the process in metaphors. It's all headlights on a dark road at night or falling down a lift shaft. She talked about the difficulty of beginnings, about being able to write anywhere and at any time, and about the laborious but ultimately very worthwhile process of perfecting her first novel. So, over to Maggie. Are you in the room where you write?
Well, actually, I'm not. I usually write. I have a place out in the garden, right at the bottom of the garden, but there's no connectivity there at all, quite deliberately. So I could sit in it, but you wouldn't be able to talk to me.
That's okay. Well, would you just pretend you're in there for a moment and just sort of paint a picture for us of what it looks like? It's interesting that you've got an office that you can't get on the internet in. But tell me all about it.
Well, I don't really think of it as, it's not very office-like. I think what I usually call it is my studio. And it was, until about 2 years ago, it was a really quite dilapidated Victorian greenhouse that was very beautiful, but actually it was very spidery and very, it actually blew down in a gale. And so we kept the red brick foundations of it, and these brilliant architects rebuilt the glass for me. And so it's got this beautiful, but it's all glass. It's like being inside the rib cage of some kind of mythical creature when you're sitting in there, particularly late at night. So it's all, and it's very screened. It's screened on one side by a big stone wall and the other side by quite thick conifer trees. So I am actually quite enclosed, but at the same time, I'm completely open to the light and the elements. It's like being outside, but inside. So this time of year, I have my wood burning stove on, and I have lots of thermals and very warm cardigans on. So I sit in there swathed in wool, with my wood burner on and most of the cats, and I'm completely isolated and very, very quiet.
It sounds fabulous.
It is. I am very lucky. And it has the world's biggest desk, so I spread out all my books and all my notes and things. It has actually, although in lockdown, it's also doubling up as hang out for teachers. So my son opens the windows and the doors and he hangs out there with his friends because there's nowhere else for them to go at the moment.
Yeah.
So it has a kind of dual purpose. I don't mind it because I think, I don't know, lockdown is not fun for teenagers and they need somewhere to go. So
absolutely,
I don't mind sharing it with him at the moment.
What's your sort of daily routine in terms of writing if you're going out there to work on something?
I don't know. I mean, the thing about routine, it's really, I don't really have a routine at all. And I think I think life with quite young children still, you know, because my eldest child's 17, my youngest is 7, that there isn't really any routine. You just have to roll with the punches and react to whatever's going on around you. And I think I've become quite used to that now, having been a mother and also a writer for almost decades. So routine is very much not part of my life at all. But I do have, I don't know, I mean, I wouldn't say I have rituals before I start writing, but I certainly, and actually in the winter, my writing, if I manage to get down the garden, my writing will start with lighting a fire. So I have to I have to clean out the grate, I have to light the fire and, you know, coax it into being, which I find sort of quite metaphorical about the act of writing as well. So I have to sort of kindle this flame and nurture it. And some days it catches really easily, and some days it takes ages and the fire won't burn and the wood seems damp, but which is actually very like writing itself. There are some days when it catches very easily and the logs burn and it crackles away and suddenly everything's great. And other days where it's much slower to start and you need to blow on it and you need to add a few more fire lighters. So yeah, there's a strange symbolism to needing to light a fire before you start writing.
Yeah. How much of a run of it do you generally get around everything else that's happening? I mean, do you have a few hours in there a day or is it?
It just depends. I mean, certainly in lockdown, it's been, my time is probably halved. It has been halved, I think. So that's tricky. But I mean, I don't know. The thing is, I think the thing you have to, if you are going to be a parent and write books, think the skill, the most important skill to learn is to be able to change horses in midstream very quickly. You know, you can't be too precious about waiting for the muse to strike you or sitting there waiting for the everything to feel right or do right. You know, you just have to be able to write wherever you are at any point on whatever surface you happen to have available. You know, I've written in the car outside the house of my daughter's having a play date, or I've written on actually walking to school to pick up my kid. You know, it's just, you can't be too precious. You have to just be able to submerge yourself in that world very, very quickly without any too much faffing around or being too precious about it.
How do you write while you're walking with your child? Is it on your phone?
With difficulty, actually. Oh, no, I never write my phone. No, I usually have notebooks with me. So I have actually leaned on the hood of a buggy and written some notes. I have, not often, but occasionally. It has been known.
Are you writing a book at the moment?
Yes, I am. So I'm writing, another novel, and I'm also writing another children's book.
Oh, that's lovely. That's exciting. And so would you talk me a little bit through, if you're working on a novel, what's your sort of process? What's your way in to start off with? And then how much plotting and planning are you doing and all of that?
Well, it's funny. I think novels are, they're all very, very different. And it reminds me a little bit actually of bringing up children, because all children, every child has its own, his or her own joys and challenges very peculiar to them. And I think novels are the same. You know, I don't ever feel that I have one method to write any one book. I don't think it would work. I think with every single novel, I feel as though I have to reinvent how to do it. You know, every novel needs to have its own process and its own way in and its own rituals and its own research. Everyone is completely different. And I feel, you know, I have a huge learning curve with each one. And certainly I think I always try to set myself some kind of task or a challenge with each one. You know, I remember when I started writing a book called Instructions for a Heatwave, I really wanted to crack polyphony. I wanted to be able to move in and out of four or five characters' heads within one scene, to have this multitude of voices. So I remember studying it, you know, as I used to study for my exams when I was at school or at university, and wanting to be able to do it. And so I think with every book you have this kind of steep learning curve, and then at the end you know you want to put everything you've learned into practice. So I think in a way every novel is a sort of reaction or an extension of its predecessor. But with this novel, I mean, it's funny, I hate talking about anything I haven't finished, so I'm not going to say too much that's specific. But there is quite a lot of research. It's also set in the past, like its predecessor, Hamnet. But it's very different. And actually, it's in a different country. So that's been quite tricky in a sense, and it's sort of an interesting challenge because I haven't been able to visit that country because, of course, I've been in lockdown.
Yeah.
So I've done a lot of reading about it and thinking about it, and it, you know, I have visited the places it's in, but not with a view to writing a book about it. So I'm writing the novel in a sense. I'm writing it blind in a way, because there are things I do want to know, and at some point I will go when it's allowed. But so I feel that it's, in a sense, I'm doing it almost backwards. But it's an interesting way of working. I quite like it.
Do you find that when you're, I mean, maybe it is different for every book, but do you find that when you're in the early stages, you start out by actually writing a few lines or a few pages or a few chapters, or do you, or does the all of the research and the thinking come first before you actually sit down to that?
No, not at all. I mean, I don't, you know, I'm much more, I don't really, I'm not much of a planner really in life or in novels. You know, I have heard other writers say that they will plan and research and will meticulously plot every single chapter before they even, you know, put pen to paper or finger to keyboard, and I'm really not like that at all. And there are some books which I feel have had a very long incubation period, and I've been circling around the idea for years, actually years and years, and you know, I might have put something down on paper or, you know, or in a notebook, or put something in a document on a computer, and then I, you know, go away from it and come back to it. But actually the one I'm writing now, I had the idea, it sort of just came to me in a moment, just over a year ago. It was last February 2020. And I was actually thinking, I'd actually started two other books because I wasn't quite sure which one I wanted to write. And what I have done in the past is have two desks set up for each, one for each book.
Really?
And I would just write, yeah. And I would write one on one desk, and maybe the next day I'd try the other one on the other desk. And I would just see which one, you know, which one the pilot light caught.
Why did you need two different desks for that?
It's sort of to do with the physical mental space. I just found that I didn't want to, because I have, you know, I will have something set up and I'll have all the books and pictures and postcards and plots and vague ideas and times of the novel and one play. And so I just needed a different space for it. But actually what happened was that I was about probably 8,000 to 10,000 words into both these books. And I just suddenly had this third idea and I thought, nope, that's the one. So I got rid of the other two and I started this one. But I think that's the shortest incubation period I've ever had for any novel. I just had this idea, it just appeared one day, and I thought, no, that's what I need to do, it's that. And so I just, everything else I've got, I mean, it hasn't been ditched. I may well write those other two books at some point, probably, but who knows.
It's interesting though to think of you with the two desks, because it makes me think that you, maybe you're someone who likes to have a lot of visual stuff in front of you. Are you sort of printing lots of things out and gathering stuff? Is that why you need a big desk, as you said at the beginning?
Possibly. I mean, you know, my desk, because I have a very small room in the house where I have a sort of desktop computer where I do my email and admin and all that stuff happens there. So in here, I'm sitting in here right now actually, but this room is really chaotic and really messy, and I find it really hard to write in a room that's very messy. I really like having pictures and postcards and photographs and maps and sort of visual planning, as I have these sort of, I have lots of plans of the book, which are, I don't know what you'd call them, like a sort of flowchart. I'm just looking at one right now. And it's the 1, 2, 3, 4. It's five different stages of the second part of the novel I'm writing, and coming off it are this sort of web-like of all these different scenes that have to be written. And I've crossed off the ones I've done, and I can see the ones that I still need to do. But I won't. I mean, I think what I really like the point at which when you've made, because I don't make plans, you know, I make sort of these diagrams in a sense of what I need to, where I think the book is going to go. But I really like it when the book itself diverges from the very vague plan or diagram that I have. I always feel at that point when the book diverges from what your vision of it is always a good point to read. It's the point at which the book has acquired its own pulse, when it says, actually, I'm not going from A to B, like your diagram says, I'm going from A to C or D. I always think that's a really good moment when it takes off on its own momentum.
So you don't resist it and try and make it stick to the plan?
Never, never, never. No, I think plans are definitely made to be broken. All rules and all plans. Yeah, no, I really like it. It's always a very good sign. And I always try to work on instinct as much as I can.
Yeah. And writing your memoir, I Am, I Am, I Am, did it feel similar to writing your novels, or did it feel like quite a different beast?
Well, it's funny. In a lot of ways, it was oddly familiar, sort of deceptively familiar in a way, you know, because on the kind of micro level, it was very familiar because, you know, a sentence is a sentence, a paragraph is a paragraph, that are very nuts and bolts level of writing, it was sort of oddly familiar, and I felt lulled into a false sense of security. But of course, you know, I was constantly pulled up by my fiction habits, because, you know, I am at heart a novelist. You know, it is what I've always wanted to do, and it's what I love to do most of all. And I would find that I'd be in the middle of a scene, so very submerged into scene, and I would suddenly think, you know, this scene would work a lot better if I had two people need to come in, they need to have this as a conversation instead of, and then I'd think, actually, God, I can't do that. You know, I felt like a horse that had been, like, my bridle had been yanked. And I think, well, actually, I can't do that, because it's not true. I have to stick to the truth. You can't elaborate. You can't just take it wherever you think best. So it was good. It was a very interesting discipline. But the truth is hard, really hard. Fiction's much, much easier to write than a memoir.
Well, I don't think everyone would agree with you on that. It's probably just that you're particularly good at the fiction.
I don't know about that.
When do you first remember being interested in writing?
Well, it's funny. I can't really remember a time in my life when I didn't have that urge to put words down on paper. And I have notebooks going back to when I was about 5 or 6. So probably, you know, around the time I really learnt to write. And I do remember saying to my mum about that time, I really want to write a poem, but I don't know how. Can you write it for me? My mum said, well, if I wrote it, it would be my poem, not yours. And I remember being really struck by that. You know, it was my first sort of introduction to the idea of authorship and ownership of something that you create. And of course, it was a very good idea. It was a very good response, because actually it spurred me on to writing something, probably something really awful, actually. But I did. I just remember, I've just always had the urge. I don't know where it came from, because it's not as if there are many writers in my family, so it's not a genetic thing, I don't think, but it's just always been there.
I wondered, your children's book originated from a story that you told your daughter sort of spontaneously when she was unwell. And it made me, hearing that made me wonder whether oral storytelling was part of your childhood, or whether you're a person who's good at spinning a yarn in conversation, because you do strike me really as a storyteller.
I think so. I mean, I'm not very verbally confident. I don't really... because I've had a stammer throughout all my childhood and my adolescence particularly, and it's still, you know, a stammer never goes away. You learn to live with it, or you learn ways to cope with it. It's always there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, speech therapists will describe a stammer as an iceberg, and you only see a tiny, tiny part of it, and then below the surface there's this huge, terrifying, frozen mass that people are still dealing with. So verbally, I don't feel very confident. I don't like to rely on my verbal skills or my oral thing, but certainly I think as my growing up, I mean, my parents read to us every night. You know, it was a big part of our life. And we used to go to the library every week, and we'd get 3 books out, and my parents would read. My dad was always very keep. My dad would only ever read Irish folk tales to us. So I did grow up with that. That was a very strong influence in my childhood. You know, and Irish folk tales are very, I mean, they're very funny, but they're very dark as well. And there's an awful lot of shape-shifting and parallel worlds and people who slip between different states. And, you know, people think of leprechauns as these sort of cute men in green, but they're not. They're quite frightening, and they need to be appeased, and they're this other world that humans can get dragged into and spat out of. So I grew up very much with that in the background of my childhood. But I think also there was an awful, I do remember there being a lot of chat in my household when I was growing up. I do remember my parents loved to talk about their day and talk about who they've met and people. Yeah, I think my family was one very interested in narrative, certainly as a kind of, but sort of not so much fictional narrative about ourselves and the people we knew and family and friends and neighbours. I remember a lot of that.
And how did writing become your career?
You know, I do find it funny when people talk about writing as a career, because it always seems to me that anyone who wants to write is really not interested in a career at all. I find it such an odd word to use for it at all. I mean, I knew that. It's funny because there's always been a very big distinction between wanting to write and being a writer, wanting to be a writer. And I think the people who want to be a writer are probably not going to I don't know. I think wanting to write is the most significant urge. That's the most important urge you can have. I think wanting to be a writer is something completely different. I never thought I could be a writer. It never even occurred to me that it was possible to do that as your job, in a way, as your main job, and, you know, be able to make a living from it or support yourself or pay your rent or your mortgage. It never occurred to me. But I knew I wanted to write. And so I thought I would just find a job that was as close to it as I possibly could. So I wanted to become a journalist. That was my plan. And I lived in Hong Kong. I went back to Hong Kong after I graduated. And I did various things, actually, a bit of waitressing and teaching. But then I got a job, actually, by lying on a computer magazine. I told them that I knew all about computers. I'd never actually touched one at the time. And so I did. I worked as an editorial assistant. And then I got a job as an editorial assistant on The Independent Sunday. And that felt like, you know, that seemed astonishing. And I was able to write a really small articles and a few reviews and book reviews and arts reviews. But at the same time, I was writing what became my first novel at that time. So that was in my mid-20s. And I think the turning point for me really was when I went on a course at the Arvon Foundation, which was about novels, and I was taught by Elspeth Barker and Barbara Trapido. And I think I was about 24 at this time, and I was still working at the Independent Sunday. I was working as a kind of desk secretary, and I went and I had about, it was probably about 15 or 20,000 words of what I thought was the first draft of the novel. When I think about it now, it was an absolute mess, dog's dinner. But I handed it in, and they said that they, after a day or two, they said they wanted to talk to me. I thought they've read what I've written, and they think it's so terrible they're going to ask me to leave. And so I went into the room really kind of, I was really worried. I thought, oh God, it's going to be really embarrassing. But actually they said, it's good, and, you know, we think you should finish it, and when you've finished it, we'll send it to our agent.
Wow.
So that was, yes, exactly. That was one of those moments. I don't know. I still remember the absolute shock and the thrill of it. So I spent the next year or so finishing it. And then I sent it to their agent. And she was very, very kind to me, because actually it was, when I think about it now, it was an absolute mess. And she said, you know, you've got 5 plots and you can probably really only have 1 or 2. And you've got far too many adverbs. And the ending doesn't really work, and there's this whole sort of supernatural strand that really isn't working. So she kind of told me to go away and rewrite it, and I did spend about another year rewriting, because she was absolutely right about everything. And at that point she sent it out and to about 5 publishers, and they all said no. And then I did another probably 6 months of rewrites, and then she sent it out again, and it did get picked up then. And that was what became my first book after you'd gone.
Wow. So you really had to stick with it for a bit to get it to that point.
Yeah, but in a way, you know, I think it was the right thing to do, because it was a mess and it wasn't right at the beginning. And I was so, you know, I was pretty young, really. I didn't really know what I was doing. I was just feeling my way. You know, I think, I don't know, the thing about novels is I think you can't know where you're going. I always think it's a bit like driving at night in the countryside without any streetlights at all, and you know you have those cat's eyes illuminating the road, and you don't know where the turns in the road are until you're actually there, until right at the last minute your headlights are illuminating where you need to go. And writing a novel's like that. You can't do it unless you're in it. You know, you can't think about it and think what it's going to be like and how it's going to be until you're actually writing it. You can't think about it in the abstract. To be in it, you've got to be in it. You've got to get your hands dirty. You've got to be right there inside the work in order to make it work.
Do you think you learned a lot from that initial experience?
Huge amounts, yes. I mean, it was a mess. It wasn't publishable at that time. And my agent was completely right to make me go back. But also, in a sense, I wonder now whether she... I'm not with the same agent. Alexandra Pringle, she went off to become an editor at Bloomsbury. And actually, her assistant is now my agent. So I've been with the same agent for 20 years. But I mean, in a sense, I think in a way... she was probably saying if I had the sort of grit and determination and labour in me, because, you know, there is an awful lot of that in writing a novel. Yes, it's a huge amount about inspiration and imagination, but you've also got to be a perfectionist. You've got to be able to work really hard. You've got to be very, very determined. And if you don't have that, you're never going to be able to finish a novel and make it work, you know, in order to... It's you know, I'd say, I don't know, I don't really, I haven't got a very mathematical brain, but I'd say it's probably 20 to 30% inspiration and imagination, and the rest is just labour.
Yeah.
You have to be ready for that, and you have to be, you have to have the right sort of personality for that. And I wonder now whether she was, I mean, also, you know, it was a mess. It did need reworking, but also maybe it was a test to say, I'll take you on as my client, but only if you are willing to put the work in, which is fair enough. It's fair enough.
I saw Marion Keyes did a sort of free kind of tutorial for anyone who, you know, I think just on Instagram for people who are interested in writing, writing a book, and she was answering some questions and so on. And she said, and she was talking about, you know, if you're trying to write your first novel and you hit a wall where something's not working, and I think somebody had said, you know, what do you do at that point? And obviously a lot of people give up at that point, a lot of people. And she said, that's when the work starts, because she said, you know, it's, sometimes people talk about writing as though it's all a process of kind of divine inspiration and magic. But actually a lot of it is just really hard work of getting it through those patches where something isn't working.
It's graft.
Yeah,
it is. But, you know, but it's enjoyable graft. I don't really understand the people who say, I hate it, it's so difficult, it's so awful, I'm so tortured. I always think, well, don't do it then. Do something else. And also, you know, you've got a job where you can sit at home in your pyjamas talking to your imaginary friends. I mean, how bad can it be, really? You know, try saying that to a coal miner.
So that was your first novel, and you've written now, you've published 8 novels, a memoir, and recently a children's book over the space of about 20 years.
I think that's right.
I think that's right. I may have got that wrong, but I think it's right. I heard you say in another interview that questioning where creative inspiration comes from is like looking at the sun. You shouldn't do it. You should just trust that it's there.
Yeah.
Does it come easily to you, creative inspiration?
I don't know, really. I mean, what do you compare it to? I've no idea. I mean, certainly there are certainly weeks where I feel, yeah, this is going okay, this is working, you know, and there are other weeks where I just think, I need to get another job. This is a disaster. Everybody's going to laugh at me. You know, it's not working. I'll never finish this book. But, you know, in a sense, you need those, you need both those states of mind, I think, to write a book, to write anything. You
know, interesting. Why both?
Well, I don't know. For me, I think it takes the form of a wave pattern. You have this big upswing of optimism and excitement and inspiration, and you think, yes, I love this idea, this is going to be, it's going to say everything I need to say, I'm going to get as close to what I want it to be, as close as I possibly can to get it to what I need it to be. And then, and so you write lots and you write lots and you get lots of words down, and then you always have, it's always followed by this big crash of a space of a couple of days or a week, and you never know, and you just think, it's all awful, I'm absolutely useless, I'm never going to finish this, you know, it doesn't work, it's all rubbish. But you need that, because, you know, you need the creative upswing in order to get words down, and then you need the terrible crash, because that's when you edit yourself, and that's when you look at your work and you think, that doesn't work, this structure doesn't work, but actually there's that one paragraph or there's that one chapter that I think is close to what I need it to be. And so it's a sort of you have your creative optimism, and then you have your slash and burn week. And then with any luck, you'll have another upswing after that. So you need to, you know, you need the creation, and then you need the editing as well.
Yeah. And do you do a lot of editing as you go along, or do you sort of push to the end and then go back?
Well, it depends. I mean, I am a real redrafter. I do lots and lots of drafts, but I think the first draft, you know, I'm sort of 3/4 of the way through a first draft now, and I tend not to reread too much at that point. I try just to put my head down and keep going. I think, you know, it goes back to the analogy I was saying about driving at night, where your headlamps are illuminating the road ahead, and it's only, you have to be there to find out where you're going. You have to be there on the road, immersed in that scenery in order to find out where you need to get to. But so I think the first draft is quite, it's a very, it's hard. All stages of writing a book are hard and delightful at the same time, you know. And I think the delight of a first draft is that you're completely immersed in your own world, and nobody knows anything about it. You know, I don't tell anyone, not even my husband, what my book is going to be about. I mean, he can probably guess if he if he walked into my study, he can see various maps and pictures. I think he knows vaguely, but I don't tell anyone anything about it if I can help it. So you are in this kind of quite, you're in this quite nice vacuum, and you're just pressing on, and you're just, you know, you're putting one foot in front of the other, and there's no pressure, and you're completely on your own. Yeah, but at the end of the first draft, I sort of look upon the first draft as a sculptor would a lump of clay or a block of marble. You know, I know that it's raw material, that it's just the stage, and actually there probably won't be there may not be that much recognisable from the first draft. You know, by the time I get to the end, by the time you get to the finished book,
yeah.
Yeah, just it's raw material, the first draft.
So you've amassed quite a large body of work now. When you look back over that, how does your relationship to your books, how has it sort of evolved over time? If you look back at one of your early novels, for example.
I mean, I have to say that I don't do that very often, really.
I suppose the experience of them, not just the actual finished product, but how do you sort of feel about them all as time goes on?
I mean, they are strange things. They're a bit like time capsules, you know. I mean, I don't tend to go back and read them, and I mean, unless I have to. There have been times when I've needed to go back and look at something, or I had to write a thing about, I can't remember what it was now, some kind of introduction for an edition, a 20-year edition of After You've Gone, my first book, so I did have to go back and look at it just to remind myself. And it is, I mean, the strange thing is that you think you've forgotten it. You know, you have a sort of vague idea of the scenery and the structure and the, you know, the concerns of the novel. But when you go back to look at it, I find that it is a really odd time capsule that sort of acts like a lift shaft in a way that you can get into it, and you can go right back down through the years and you can remember. You know, I find it, if I open a book that I've written at random, even when I think I have a very, very dim grasp on it, I can read a sentence and I can remember the rest of the paragraph.
Really?
And I can remember where I first wrote it. I can remember the desk or the table or the cafe table or the bedsit that I was living in or whatever. You can just recall it. It's a very strange experience going back to the old work.
Mm. Is there anything that you feel you haven't achieved yet that you really want to achieve in your writing?
Oh, I hope there's a lot. I don't know what it is yet, but I really hope so. I hope I never have that feeling where I think, yes, I've written the book. You know, I think I've written a book and it's perfect. I mustn't change the word. It's exactly what I need it to be, because I think that's the point at which you're going to stop, isn't it?
I suppose that's
right. I think always at the end of a book, even if you feel as though you've come close to what it is you wanted to, you know, you set out to do, I think you always have that slightly scratchy feeling of dissatisfaction with it. You always think, you know, I did the best I could, but I didn't get to exactly where I needed it to be. It's always going to be, you're always going to have a slight sense of disappointment in yourself and the manuscript. But I think you need that, because that's what spurs you on to writing the next book. I hope I never not have it, because I think I'll be done then.
Yeah. Your books tend to deal with sort of pretty heavy life and death stuff, secrets, grief. There's a lot of grief in your novels. Obviously, Hamnet is a strong example of that, but it's not just Hamnet. What do you think brings you back to those themes?
I don't know. It's hard. I mean, in a sense, I think I'm probably the worst person to ask that question to, because I think I do take a very deliberate ostrich approach to that. And I think, going back to what you were saying about looking at the sun, I try never to examine it too much. I never, you know, it's one of the reasons I never read my reviews, because, not because I'm particularly scared about people saying mean stuff about my books, but even the ones that I know or people have told me that are good, I don't want to read them, because I think you shouldn't examine yourself too much, because I think you need to, or I need to anyway, I need to write in a completely unselfconscious bubble. You know, I don't ever want to read, you know, her concerns of this or her themes of this or whatever. You know, I think you don't need to hear yourself explain to yourself. I think it's actually very bad for you. You should just be writing the books you want to write. You should be writing the books you can't not write. You shouldn't be writing to some to fulfill some expectation or explanation about you or your work. So I don't know, but I think, I mean, the only thing I would say about grief is I think that grief is the sort of other side. It's the wrong side of love, isn't it?
Mm.
You know, if you imagine love pulled inside out on itself like a sock or a glove, grief is going to be the other side of it. Because I think a huge part of loving another person is fear of loss, you know, fear of what your life would be like without them if they went away or if they, God forbid, if they died. That's what binds you to them in a way, isn't it? So I suppose I'm interested in exploring the reverse of love.
Mm. I think it's interesting that we are drawn to read those stories. You know, if you described Hamnet to me and said it's a, you know, it's a book about a couple who lose their child, the fact that I would then go, oh, I'd love to read that, is a bit weird. You know, do you think that those painful stories are allowing readers to sort of, what I always think, to sort of safely rehearse things that actually, you know, painful experiences?
Possibly, but I think, I mean, I think the idea of Hamnet being about a couple who lose their son, I mean, that's half the story, literally.
Yes, sorry, No,
because I think you're right. I mean, it's funny, I remember I told a friend of mine and she said, I don't read dead kid books. I thought, oh God, is that a genre? That's what a horrible, terrible story. The idea that, you know, I was imagining in capital letters, oh God, that's a terrible thing. But I suppose, like, you know, what I wanted to do with Hamnet, is that I always felt that he, as the boy, the real Hamlet Shakespeare, has never been given the significance that he deserves. You know, I feel he's been relegated to a literary footnote. And I wanted to say to my readers, you know, this boy was important. He was grieved. You know, his short life is crucial. You know, without it, we wouldn't have Hamlet and we probably wouldn't have Twelfth Night. So I think in a way I wanted it to be a sort of reinvention or a recognition of his very, very short life and what it meant to his parents, because I feel that he's been overlooked. And so many biographers say, I've read so many times biographers saying, you know, oh well, it's impossible to know, you know, if there's any link between this boy and the play. You think, he's got the same name. How can you say, you know, it's not a decision that any writer would take lightly. You know, the idea that he'd think, oh, well, I'll just give it the same name as my son, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't mean anything. I mean, it's, you know, it's crazy to think that. So in a way, I didn't want it to be a book just about the death of a child. I mean, it is about the death of the child, but it's also, I wanted it to be a celebration of his life. I wanted his life to be significant. I wanted him to be heard. I wanted to give him a voice and a presence.
I mean, you know, you've really succeeded in that. And he's such a, it's so touching to see, to see him, you know, alive and the little character that he is, and so reminiscent of children that we all know. That's what makes the whole book so incredibly poignant.
Thank you.
You won the Women's Prize for Fiction for that one, and you've also won the Somerset Maugham Award and the Costa Novel Award. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about awards and prizes, if that's not a question that you're sick of answering?
No, not at all. Well, I think, I don't know, the awards and prizes are, I mean, obviously it's a wonderful phone call to get when somebody rings you up and tells you that. It's always amazing when you get some kind of response from a reader, you know, whether or not it's, you know, a prize jury or whether it's somebody who writes to you and says, I read your book and I thought this about page whatever, or I know, or even if it's just a child in a queue, you know, in a bookshop wanting to ask you about snow angels or I don't know, that kind of thing. It's always an amazing moment because, you know, it is for most of the life of a writer, it is you and your computer screen or you and your blank page. And it's always incredible to have that connection, that moment where you realise there are people out there who have, also a few, you know, some people out there who have read your book and they have, you know, for whatever reason want to tell you something or about some response. So it's always wonderful. But it's, you know, I think the thing about prizes, it is lovely to get that recognition and it's wonderful. But, you know, I've been on enough prize juries to know that it is very, very arbitrary, and it's a huge amount is to do with luck and just there's somebody on the panel who happens to like your work, you know. So it is, you have to, you can't let it, you can't, I mean, I don't know, go to your head is the wrong phrase, but you just have to think of it as an incredibly good luck. It's like winning the lottery.
Yeah.
And then you have to sort of forget about it in a sense and move on because you've got to get back to the work.
Yeah. What have you learnt over the last 20 years or so that has improved your writing? Can you think of any lessons you could share?
Goodness. So many things. I mean, like, I don't know, everything in life is, you can channel into your writing. I think what I'd wish I'd known at the beginning, when I was starting out anyway, is that beginnings are very hard. And in a sense, you don't have to begin at the beginning. I think I didn't know that for a while. It took me a while to work that out.
So you begin in the middle and then go back and fill in.
I think you don't have to, because I've always, you know, that moment where you set your first words down on paper, or your, you know, I think there is a struggle sometimes, particularly at the beginning, actually, where I thought, I have to, what's my first line going to be? Where do I start? You know, how do I begin? And it is hard. I think beginnings, I think my openings, or I should say maybe, are the bits that I've often drafted the most or redrafted the most. So now I don't worry about it too much. I think if I was going to say to anyone, just plunge in, doesn't matter where you start. In a sense, one of the first decisions you think you have to take as a writer is to look at the chronology of your narrative, and you think, at what point along this line do I leap in? Is it near the end? Is it in the beginning? Is it right at the chronological beginning? But actually, in a way, it doesn't really matter. The most important thing is just to get words down on paper, you know, to set your characters in a room and get them talking to each other or arguing or doing something. That's the beginning you need to make. And actually, I've found again and again that my first line, my opening line, has been lurking somewhere maybe 20 pages into my first draft, and it's, you know, there it is then. But it's, you know, the opening line is not always the line that I wrote first, but very, very rarely.
What makes for a good opening line then?
Well, you have to, I don't know, it's hard because you have this, the opening line has to do so many things. It's got to get your reader's attention, it's got to tell them where they are in time and space. It's got to introduce your character. It's got to introduce. It's a lot. There's a lot riding on the first line. That's why it's so hard.
What do you feel proudest of looking back at what you've done so far?
I don't know. The only thing I'm proud of are my children, I think.
Really?
I try not to be proud of my work, because I think you have to think about the things that worked in a way, that worked well, that came off, and things that didn't, and that's the way you move forward. I try not to think about pride in work. No, I think of my children, I'm so proud of my children, the people they are. Not that I'm not taking credit for it, I'm just proud of the people they are, and that I've been able to look after them for the years that they spend in the house. But that's my only pride, I think.
You're not proud of yourself for mastering the what did you call it?
Polyphony.
Polyphony. I can't even say the word.
I don't know. I'm not saying I'm proud of myself. I wanted to learn how to do it. And maybe I did. I think I tried it anyway. I gave it a go. I don't know if I pulled it off or not.
That was Maggie O'Farrell, and her latest book, Hamnet, is now out in paperback. You can buy that or her memoir, I Am, I Am, I Am, or several of her other books in my shop on bookshop.org, alongside others by guests of the podcast, plus a few books that I just think are great or useful for writers. You'll find it at uk.bookshop.org/shop/in-writing, which is also in the show notes. I've really loved making this series, so a big final thank you to all of the guests and to every single one of you who's listened to it. If this is the first episode you've come across, or somehow you've come to it late in the game, there are 31 episodes out there in total, hopefully more to come, not so far from now. But in the meantime, do go back, and I think you will find lots of gems of writing wisdom. Thank you again, and bye for now.